Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Apologize for the late start. Had some technical difficulty this evening. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. We have lots of news of interest for you tonight, but first let's go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey there, David. How are you tonight? Glad we got started. I hope everybody's doing well out there. All you veterans, you know, hope you're having a good evening. Hope you had a good weekend. I want to remind our listeners that we are also a call-in show, so you can let us know what is on your mind as far as veteran issues. Our toll-free call-in number covering the entire United States is 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. And as I say every week, this is a call-in show. So veterans, you know, this is your show. It's the Veterans News Hour. David and I are messengers for you all. So give us a call and let us know what's on your mind. Tell us about what may be happening to you at the VA or one of your friends or a family member may know what's something that's bothering a certain veteran or, you know, whatever the case may be. Tune in, you know, and give us a call. Let us know what's going on. This past week I was up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I had a hearing for a veteran up there before the Board of Veteran Appeals. It was kind of unique and kind of fun because the hearing was actually held in the federal courthouse in downtown Winston-Salem. Most of the time, these hearings are held at usually the regional offices, which are more of a kind of a blah building, office building type of setting. But this was in the actual federal courthouse, so it was very fun to be there. You know, same old types of issues that all you veterans are aware of. This veteran was in Special Forces. He had parachuted over 800 times in Iraq, Bosnia, Kosovo. He was in, like I said, Special Forces. All sorts of stuff went on with this young man. And he served there about 21 years. He was in the service. And, you know, he gets out. And he got an initial rating back in October of 2006, minimal rating for 10-20%. I think 10% for his back. His back is, you know, you can only imagine 800 parachute jumps, how your back must feel after 20 years. Well, the VA gave him a minimal rating. Followed up by that years later when he went for an increase, they, of course, denied it, saying it was getting better. And, in fact, on one of his conditions, which was his elbow, they decided they were going to reduce the 20% that they had finally given him down to 0%. This infuriated the federal judge. He was absolutely appalled during the hearing when I reminded the judge that this veteran had been reduced, and the judge absolutely couldn't. You know, he was on the record, so he couldn't say anything about how he really felt. But he was furious. And he even looked at me and said, hey, you know, I'm going to address this, you know, right off the bat and get him back up to his 20%, which I thought was extraordinary that he would do that. But, you know, one of the things the judge said that was very important about why you do want to have these hearings and why you do want to attend, if you're able to attend, is that, you know, one, you've got this process where it's a give-and-take process. The judge and the veteran and myself can engage back and forth, and depending on who your judge is going to be and how open they are to this type of dialogue, you'd be amazed at what can happen for the veteran, such as when the judge learned that, you know, the veteran had been reduced from 20 to 0% for his forearm. You know, the judge was just, you know, he talked about that, and the judge asked him all sorts of questions about his forearm, and obviously not only hasn't the condition improved, but it's gotten worse. So the judge even made that remark that this is why, as a veteran, you really do want to show up for these hearings if you can, because it does give you the opportunity. Even if you have, like and David and I, we always produce and write up a nice legal memorandum on behalf of the veteran. We usually have supporting evidence, a statement from the veteran, maybe some corroborating statements from family members or buddy statements, and maybe some medical evidence that we attach. Even after all that, the actual hearing gives the judge a little bit more leeway to kind of go off script and kind of talk about what's pressing, what's maybe not in all of those documents. So, you know, that was something that came out of that hearing that, you know, I kind of took home when I flew back to Florida, because I know a lot of times my veterans, recent veterans, have said that they wanted to pass on actually attending the BVA hearings because of the drive. It was too much for them. You know, it would be an all-day event. And, you know, a lot of times we just send in the legal memorandum and with all the supporting documents. But, you know, the judge reminded me that, you know, you may want to really consider having those hearings. And I know it can be a pain in the neck having to drive down, but to St. Pete, but it's worth it. Which also reminds me, last week I mentioned that the BVA, Board of Veteran Appeals, is now going to start doing, or they have already started doing them, these teleconference hearings. And these teleconference hearings can be done either in your representative or your lawyer's office, or you can actually do them at the veteran's home, right, the veteran's dining room table, as long as you can put together the proper system so that you can go online with the judge. So, again, some more great stuff about the BVA. And, you know, David, one of the things I think that I was thinking about this when I was up in Winston, with the way the VA is now treating their new system, and you and I both have said all they're doing is kicking the can down the road and kicking it up to the BVA, we're going to start having, I think, a lot more BVA hearings than we may have had in the past. I think the BVA is going to be working a lot harder than it had been, only because the VA doesn't seem to want to work hard. So anyway, I've kind of talked a lot here. What do you think, David?
Well, it's interesting. I know you had shared with me that, if I recall, that the judge in North Carolina, the hearing was what, 75 minutes?
75 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, and that compared to a hearing I had with a BVA judge. It was a video conference hearing, but it was video conference under the old style of video conference, which is much more limited than what you just described. But that judge and that video conference, which has been used by the VA for probably a decade now, which is the judge is sitting in an office at the Board of Veterans Appeals in Washington, D.C., and you have to go to the regional office in your state and sit in the conference room using VA equipment, using VA recording equipment and video equipment and a TV screen, and have the video conference live with the judge. The judge can see you via camera and vice versa. I've not yet seen anything on what you've described for an expanded video conference where a veteran might have the hearing from his or her own home or representative's office. That's interesting. But as going back to the point, excuse me, about the duration of the hearing, the BVA judge I had earlier this month announced that at the beginning it was, you know, the hearing was 30 minutes, and sure enough, the paperwork, the letter that had been sent out, and it was sent out on BVA letterhead, Board of Veterans Appeals letterhead, not regional office letterhead, said the hearing duration would be 30 minutes. So it's interesting to see the disparity or the inconsistency, whatever you want to call it, among BVA procedures, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future. I think that more and more veterans and their representatives, as time goes on, will learn that this appeals modernization program that the VA really pushed through Congress is only going to do what you said, Rick, which is push the can down the road away from the regional offices to the BVA. I think the time will tell, at least from my personal opinion, whether that's going to result in more BVA hearings as opposed to other BVA actions without hearings. Because, you know, if they do start cutting the hearings down to 30 minutes and they start enforcing that, and if you have the BVA judges, like the judge I had, really start scrutinizing cases with an eye towards the BVA no longer having a duty to assist, which is what they had in prior years by law, I think it's going to be a less friendly audience for veterans and their representatives, or less receptive audience. I think it's going to be a tougher audience, the BVA appeals. Of course, some judges, like the one you had, sounded very helpful, but I'm just concerned that as they get more cases, because cases are being kicked up to the BVA level, that the BVA is going to start doing everything they can to minimize their own work, and we'll have to see. But I'm pretty much of a cynic about the VA and the BVA and what they're going to do. So my advice to veterans out there is, you better get used to a system where there's less assistance from the VA and more of a burden on you and your representative to build your case, build the evidence, present it, and doing it as with an overwhelming fashion so even the VA can't miss it. So I had an interesting follow-up to the hearing I had in St. Pete a few weeks ago. I had sent in our pretty voluminous appeals package, a legal memorandum, supporting statements, disability benefit questionnaire. And I sent it to both the BVA and the intake office in Janesville, Wisconsin. And today I get in the mail, and the veteran got a copy, a letter from the VA acknowledging receipt of that and interpreting it as if it were an attempt to file a notice of disagreement. Well, that was absurd. It was absurd because we are clearly at the BVA level. The memo said this is a memorandum for the Board of Veterans Appeals. It was addressed to the BVA. And furthermore, if they bothered reading beyond the first couple sentences, they would have seen that this was a memo in support of a VA Form 9 that had been filed 3 years ago, long before the Appeals Modernization Act had even been enacted. So, and not only that, but the letter that I received today saying, we received your correspondence of this date where it appears you're attempting to file a notice of disagreement. Then they sent the old notice of disagreement form. You know, they referenced that as what we would use as opposed to the new forms with the new program. So it's just another example of complete VA incompetence. So anyway, I'm glad I got that off my chest, but it really is frustrating to deal with the VA. So over to you, Rick.
Well, yeah, I think I'm having it's like a merry-go-round dealing with the 0995 form, the decision review supplemental claim form, and the 526 EZ form. And one of the things that the 526 EZ, I'm trying to, for any veterans that are out there and you're in the process of doing a claim, it's a 21-526 EZ, and you'll see it there. It's the application for benefits. So if you're going to use that form, and if you're doing it by yourself or you've got a representative, that form is only good if you've never opened up, you never filed a claim for a particular disability. The other form I referred to, which is the newer form, the 20-0995, that form is supposed to be for if you're reopening, appealing through the supplemental claim appeal process, which we've talked about before, or you're seeking an increase, then the claim has to be put on that form. Sounds easy enough. The problem that I run into is when I've interviewed new clients and we talk about the the existing claims and old claims. And then I say, well, are there any other claims that you think you should file for today that you didn't file for before? Oh, yes, the claim for, I'm just going to make this one up, claim for my left shoulder. Okay, great. So I get all the forms out there that need to be out there, and then I put down on the EZ form, the 526EZ, the left shoulder claim. Then I get a letter from the VA and says, you've used the wrong form. That claim was previously denied by the VA back in 2001. They don't even tell you what year, quite frankly. They just say it's previously. Then I get in touch with the client and I say, by the way, did you ever file a claim for that shoulder? Well, I didn't think so. Ever. Well, yeah, I think I did back in 1999. I did. Okay. So now I got to put that claim back on the 0995. The reason I'm saying this to you is, veterans, is that in the last 6 months, I've had to go back and refile the different forms depending on the actual status of the claim that we are now pursuing. So again, the 526EZ is the form you use if you've never, ever previously claimed a particular disability. And then the 0995 is for everything else. I don't know if
Rick,
you've run into that problem yet. Yeah, go ahead, David.
Can I add something interesting? Was I had a client, a veteran, recently, and we had filed. There had been an adverse decision. So under this Appeals Modernization Act, the modern program, you know, one of the three options is to file a supplemental claim in response to that. And my understanding is you have 1 year to do that and still preserve your effective date. Well, we did that, but it also, they make it clear in the instructions for the supplemental claim that you have to, the burden is on the veteran, and correct me if you've had a different experience, Rick, but the burden is on the veteran to provide some new evidence, right, to go with the supplemental claim. Well, we did that with a very thorough personal statement which described in detail the worsening of the symptoms for the disabilities that had been had a lowball rating that we were appealing with the supplemental claim. Well, I thought that that would be enough, you know, because the law is pretty clear, and I'm not aware that there's any case law that changed it, that the veteran is competent to testify about symptoms that a layperson can observe. Not a medical doctor. You don't need a medical opinion for things that are obvious. Well, that's what we put in the statement, and I thought that would be enough to trigger a new C&P exam, right, under the supplemental claim. I would think that that's the least that the VA would at least they would be willing to do that, right? You follow me so far? That they would order a C&P exam based on the veteran saying, here are my worsening symptoms from the previous rating. Well, we got a decision back, and you know what C&P exam they relied on? From 4 years ago. They said, your prior C&P exam. So, of course, now we're going to have to appeal that, wasting more time. And it's just... having little faith in the other, in the second of the options, which is the higher level review, which is clearly just a rubber stamp of what's already happened, we're left with appealing to the board, knowing that that's still probably going to take a few years, but also realizing that at this point we're going to have to make an extra effort to get private doctor, a non-VA doctor, to complete a DBQ. We had tried that before, but his private doctor was just unwilling. You know, he didn't want to get involved with the VA, and that's why we had not been successful before. But I think what we've seen is the VA's duty to assist, even though they supposedly still have it at the initial claim level, even with the supplemental claim, their duty to assist is minimal compared to what it used to be. And or at least that's the position they're taking. I'm sure we're going to have to, a lot of veteran representatives across the country are going to be fighting these issues. But... it's what we predicted going back 2 years ago, that the Appeals Modernization Act is simply a conduit for the VA to do less work and to shove more burden on, more work onto the veterans. So it's unfortunate, but we predicted it. And now, you know, we've just got to, excuse me, adjust our strategies work around that.
But on another note, veterans, yes, we've brought up a couple of things that are very frustrating, and I'm sure you've had any veteran who's been going through the process, you understand the frustration as well. But what I want to remind every veteran that's out there, if you continue to push the case, if you don't give up, you are going to be successful, because we will wear them down before they wear us down. And ultimately, you'll get somebody who's going to look at the case, realize the injustice that has been done, and fix it. If you're a younger veteran, you've got some wait time there, which you can handle. For an older veteran, I understand the frustration because of your age. And then remember, if you're over 75, you can have your case expedited. So, no matter what you hear and the frustration you may hear from David and myself, if you stay in the boat, which I like to say, you stay in the boat and you keep moving down the river, ultimately you're gonna get to where you need to be. But you just have to go through the hurdles that the VA is putting out in front of us, as unfortunate that might be. Hey, David, you got some news for us.
Yeah, I got some news, but you're absolutely right, Rick. I think, and what I often tell clients is just know what you're up against. The regional offices tend to produce poor quality work for the most part, and that may require persistence, but you can't quit, because when you quit, then the VA will definitely win, and that's just not right, So, anyway, let's move on to some news tonight. I wanted to repeat an item that we had mentioned last week. We have a lot of Vietnam veterans out there who might find this of interest, and that is that the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the VFW, is still accepting entries for its annual Return to Vietnam trip drawing. So if you're a Vietnam veteran and you received a Purple Heart for being wounded in Vietnam, you could be one of nine fortunate veterans to win this in-country tour of Vietnam, which will be next April, April the 16th to the 29th of 2020. Kind of funny to say that the year 2020, it's how time flies, but this Vietnam trip will be April 16th to the 29th of 2020. The trip will include visits to many cities, Hanoi, Saigon, which is now called Ho Chi Minh City, the Demilitarized Zone, Khe Sanh, Hue, Da Nang, Hoi An, Marble Mountain, Kuchi, and Tay Ninh, with airfare, accommodation, and meals included. Entries will be received prior to the drawing on November 19th, 2019. Let me just digress for a second. Over the weekend, I was speaking with retired Lieutenant Colonel John O'Brien, who was on our show back in 2017. He's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, but now he has a PhD in history now, and he's one of the installation historians at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And he made a trip with a group of other Americans to Vietnam not long ago for historical purposes. So I asked him, I said, what was it like in Vietnam? And he said the country, first of all, it's a beautiful country, just geographically, it's just a beautiful country, but it's also thriving economically. He said, yeah, they've got a communist government, but most people seem to succeed in as far as being entrepreneurs and working in business and being successful, are able to kind of ignore the government, and the government apparently, for the most part, ignores them. So he says it's kind of ironic, or it's kind of interesting to see how Vietnam has turned out, decades after the war. And he said, you don't find resentment against Americans. You don't find bitterness, really, about the war. A lot of tourists going to Vietnam. He said, what's interesting is that the Vietnamese have more of a historical animosity towards, among others, the Chinese, and not so much the Americans. But in any event, going back to the point, if you're a Vietnam War veteran and a Purple Heart recipient, and you're interested in going back to Vietnam, you may want to enter this Return to Vietnam trip drawing that the VFW is hosting. The deadline for entering is November 29th, 2019, and the trip will be next April. Winners will be notified by mail or email after the drawing. To claim your trip after that, you'll have to send a copy of certain documentation to the VFW National Headquarters by January and have all your paperwork, your passport ready to go. The trip will include mainly Vietnamese meals, but also include American food on some occasions, long bus rides, excessive walking, and there are no handicap facilities anywhere on the trip, so just be aware of that. Everyone must participate in every inland trip and activity, so please consider these points before entering the drawing. Previous VFW sponsor trip winners to various events are not eligible. However, don't miss this opportunity to revisit battle sites, share your experiences with fellow Vietnam veterans, and for more information or to download the entry form, go to vfw.org, that's vfw.org, and look for the link under the Media and Events tab on that website. And it'll tell you also where to send the entry form. So, any event, we have more news of interest. So, Rick, over to you.
Thank you, David. The National Veterans Legal Services Program is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that has worked since 1981 to ensure that the government delivers to our nation's 22 million veterans and active duty personnel the benefits to which they are entitled. Its website is NV as in Victor, LSP.org. We have news today from NVLSP. Last Monday, September 9th, 2019, the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims struck down a VA regulation denying veterans reimbursement of emergency medical expense. I know this comes up quite a bit when I get phone calls from veterans. The court ruled in a case called Wolf versus Wilkie that VA's 2018 reimbursement regulation violates the Emergency Care Fairness Act of 2010 that requires the VA to reimburse veterans for the emergency medical expenses they incur at non-VA facilities that are not covered by the veterans' private insurance. The CAVC certified the case as a class action and ordered the VA to remedy its unlawful regulation by reimbursing veterans for all of their past and future out-of-pocket emergency medical expenses not covered by the veterans' private insurance other than copayments. The class action petition was filed on behalf of the veterans, Amanda Wolf, and Peter Boschinger by the National Veterans Legal Services Program, NVLSP, and Sydney Austin, LLP, on a pro bono basis. Well, that's good news there, David.
Oh, it is. So this is an issue that's been around for a long time, and there have been developments over the last year, so it's good to hear what's going on. And NVLSP is a great organization. Check out its website, and if you can, you know, consider all the great work they do for veterans. You may even want to donate to it. As Rick said, it's a 501c3 nonprofit organization. But we have more news from the NVLSP tonight. This ruling is the second time that the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims struck down the VA regulation governing reimbursement of emergency medical expenses. And we reported this on previous shows. 5 years ago, the organization appealed to the CAVC on behalf of veteran Richard Staub after the VA declined to reimburse him for any of the $48,000 he incurred for emergency open heart surgery purely because Medicare covered part of the emergency care bill. In the CAVC's 2016 landmark presidential decision in Staub versus Shulkin, which we discussed at that time, the court invalidated the VA's regulation that prohibited reimbursement for any of the veterans' emergency medical expenses merely because some but not all the expenses were covered by the veterans' insurance. The court said in the Staub case that Congress intended for the VA to step in as a secondary payer where other health care insurers cover only a portion of the cost of the emergency treatment, and the regulation violated that statute, the federal statute. So the ruling from last week struck down the regulation that the VA promulgated in 2018 to replace the regulation which was struck down in the Staub case in 2016. So the VA is now 0-2 in throwing roadblocks. You know, they've thrown roadblocks up to these poor veterans. You know, they have to go to a civilian, a non-VA emergency room, for instance, for emergency care, and end up with tens of thousands or more of bills. that the VA should have been covering in the first place. So what are the consequences, Rick? What can you tell us about the consequences or the likely ramifications?
Well, according to NVLST, based on the VA's past estimates, compliance with the veterans' yesterday's decisions will require VA to pay from $1.8 billion to $6.5 billion in reimbursements to hundreds of thousands of veterans with reimbursement claims filed or pending during the period from 2016 to 2025. That's not million, ladies and gentlemen. That's billion. So whatever the, you know, David, you and I always talk about, you know, it's all about the money. Well, that's just another example of it all being about the money. The court's decision writes, a terrible injustice in its order ensures that veterans who were unjustly denied reimbursement for critical emergency treatment at non-VA facilities will finally be reimbursed, said NVLSP Executive Director Bart Stichman. It is a hard-won victory for hundreds of thousands of veterans, especially those like Mr. Staub, Ms. Wolf, Mr. Boschinger, for whom reimbursement is long overdue. The court was unequivocal in yesterday's decision. After Staub, VA adopted a new regulation excluding from reimbursement nearly every type of expense a veteran could have incurred if he or she had insurance covering a portion of the medical service at issue. So after Staub, the VA adopted a regulation that functionally creates a world indistinguishable from the world Staub authoritatively held impermissible under the statute. It's difficult to conceive how an agency could believe that adopting a regulation that mimics the result of a federal court held to be unlawful is somehow appropriate when the statute at issue has not changed. But there is more. Even after we decided Staub, the VA has affirmatively informing veterans that they were not entitled to reimbursement for non-VA emergency medical care if they had any insurance covering the service at issue. In other words, the agency was telling veterans that the law was exactly opposite to what a federal court had held the law to be. In its ruling, the CAVC explained why it granted the petition in the same order that it certified the class action. And I quote, given the unique circumstances surrounding this case, particularly the nature of the alleged injury and the need for prompt remedial action, resolving both matters in a single order is appropriate here. This is only the second time in the CVAC's 30-year history that has granted a class action. In June 2019, CVAC certified its first class action in Godsey versus Wilkie, also brought by the NVLSP. Looks like Secretary Wilkie is not doing too well. So that's great news, huh, David?
It certainly is. And for veterans that may already be in this situation where the VA is trying to pawn off medical bills, check out the NVLSP.org website and let that organization know, because they've been involved for quite a few years now and working with some large law firms in D.C. And they're going to continue fighting the VA. It'll be interesting to see what the VA does next, see if they get the message. But in any event, Rick, I know we have some more to talk about.
I got another issue, another interesting issue. In fact, one of my clients, the widow of one of my clients, came in today go over the BVA's decision in her husband's case. Her husband was a Navy veteran. You know where I'm going with this, David. And he was denied. He served in Vietnam, off the coast of Vietnam, and he was denied Agent Orange presumption. Well, the BVA in that decision, and he had coronary artery disease. Well, in that decision, the BVA service connected the veteran and had and remanded the case back to the VA for further development. And this is just one of many issues affecting Navy veterans. It's amazing. The change in the law occurred in 2019, and what the change was, it enabled thousands of veterans who served on ships in the waters offshore of Vietnam to obtain VA disability benefits for diseases associated with exposure to Agent Orange. The change in the law should also enable survivors of these veterans to obtain VA death compensation for deaths due to diseases associated with Agent Orange exposure. In my client's case, we filed in 2017, 2 years prior to the change in the law, and unfortunately he passed away a year ago, but we continued the case forward. So, David, what is this change in law, and how did it come about?
Well, it's a major, major change. That a lot of organizations, like Military Veterans Advocates, headed by retired Commander John Wells, has been on the show a number of times. It's a big issue for the so-called Blue Water Navy veterans of the Vietnam War. Earlier this year, in a case called Procopio versus Wilkie, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit ruled that the Agent Orange Act of 1991 requires the VA to presume that those who served in the territorial waters offshore Vietnam were exposed to Agent Orange. And the court ruled that this presumption applies to all veterans who served within 12 nautical miles of Vietnam during the Vietnam War. Congress, this past summer, then enacted the Blue Water Navy Veterans, the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2019, which incorporated the Procopio's decision. The act states that a veteran who, during active military, naval, or air service, served offshore of the Republic of Vietnam during the period beginning January 9th of 1962 and ending on May 7th, 1975, shall be presumed to have been exposed to Agent Orange, and the term offshore is defined as no more than 12 nautical miles seaward of a line commencing on the southwestern demarcation line of the waters of Vietnam and Cambodia. Now, Rick, I remember when John Wells was on our show, he was executive director of the Military Veterans Advocacy Organization, and a major force in veterans law, lobbied Congress a lot, met with the VA secretary and other people, that John indicated that his view was that this particular act as written was a mistake in that it actually narrowed the path for other veterans that may have been stationed further out. That was my understanding of what he said on some of our prior shows. So he was not happy with this, and, of course, a lot of veteran groups and members of Congress then acted as if they were, you know, the driving force behind this law, when in fact, it appeared that they were actually probably defeating efforts that would have expanded it. But in any event, you may be asking, what does this change mean for the Blue Water veterans? According to the National Veterans Legal Services Program, it means that a veteran covered by the Procopio decision and the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2019 should become entitled to service-connected disability benefits if the veteran files a claim for disability benefits with the VA and suffers from one of the diseases that the VA already recognizes as being associated with Agent Orange exposure.
But David, what does this law mean for survivors of deceased Blue Water Vietnam veterans?
Well, according to the National Veterans Legal Services Program, it means that a qualifying survivor, such as a surviving spouse of a veteran who was covered by the Procopio decision and the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2019, and that veteran died from a disease that the VA recognizes as associated with Agent Orange exposure, should become entitled to service-connected death compensation, known as dependency and indemnity compensation, if the veteran files claim for that, so-called DIC claim. And the list of diseases is actually quite lengthy. It's too lengthy for me to read the entire list now, but they include various cancers, lung cancer, cancer of the larynx. Some of the more common ones include prostate cancer, ischemic heart disease, Parkinson's disease, type 2 diabetes, various types of leukemia. But the list is longer than that. You can find the list on the website va.gov. But that's basically the major consequence, Rick.
So, David, I think a common question might be, do I need to file another claim if I already filed a claim for benefits of an Agent Orange-related disease and that claim is still pending at the VA?
Well, according to the National Veterans Legal Services Program, if the claim is still pending, the answer is no, you don't need to file another one. If you're sure your claim is still pending, again, you don't need to file another claim, but if you wish to file a statement with the VA in support of your pending claim, you may wish to do so, stating that you believe you're entitled to benefits under the Procopio decision, as well as under the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2019. And hopefully the VA will actually read that and apply the law correctly.
Okay, then. Do I need to file another claim if my previous claim for an Agent Orange-related disease was finally denied by the VA and is no longer pending?
Yeah, if it's been denied and no longer pending, the word from the National Veterans Legal Services Program is yes, you need to file another claim. If you have not previously filed a disability claim for a disease the VA recognizes associated with Agent Orange, then you should file a claim for those using the form that you discussed earlier, Rick, the VA form 21-526 EZ. It's not such an easy form, but I guess the VA thinks they got to keep up with the IRS with easy forms. So there is a form for that. Now if you had previously filed a disability claim for a disease the VA now recognizes as associated with Agent Orange, and the VA finally denied that claim, then you should file a supplemental claim for disability compensation for that disease using the form VA 20-0995, which is what you discussed earlier tonight, Rick. Same scenario. And the advice from the National Veterans Legal Services Program is, on that form, then you check the block that you're seeking compensation benefits, and then write in block 13A, that you believe you're entitled to disability benefits. Then you include the specific Agent Orange-related disease. And then you cite the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2019 and the Procopio decision. Now, if you're wondering, well, I can't write down all these notes as fast as you're talking tonight on the show, here's my advice. Go to nvlsp.org, and on their search engine, on their homepage, you'll see some links to the Blue Water Navy issue. But you can use their website search engine and just for Blue Water Navy, and look for their frequently asked question section, and it'll provide you more details about this. So it's a great organization. Go ahead.
Or David, and we'll give our information out at the end of the show. You can contact David or myself, and we'll be happy to go through all of this with you again.
Right.
Yes, it is mind-boggling, to say the least.
Good point. Yep. So
anyway,
now,
David, let me
talk about something real quick, Rick, because we
about
had mentioned
the DIC claim.
Yes, because you had asked me, what about survivors? Well, there's a different form for survivors filing for dependency and indemnity compensation.
Right.
And that's VA form 21P-534EZ. That's 21P-534EZ. But again, it's not the easiest form in the world, so you better get yourself a competent representative to help you with that. But there's a lot of good information on the NVLSP website, and that's why I've mentioned that. So, Rick, back over to you.
Well, I was going to ask you another question. You're
go
on
ahead.
A roll here.
Okay.
If my claim is granted, how much will I be entitled to in retroactive benefits?
Well, that's a good question. Very astute question.
I think that's what it comes down to. It's about, you know, the compensation.
The effective date is very important, because you know the trick the VA will do is they'll pick the date, the most recent date they can, and say that's when your claims are your benefits are effective. When in fact the law might require them to go back much earlier in time. So the effective date assigned by the VA is usually the date the claim was received by the VA. For example, if the VA grants benefits based on the veteran's first claim for an Agent Orange-related disease and that claim was filed in January 2019, The veteran should be assigned an effective date and will be, should be paid retroactively to January 2019. However, if the VA grants benefits based on a veteran's second or third claim for the same Agent Orange-related disease, the effective date should be retroactive to the date the VA received the veteran's first claim for that disease. And I emphasize the word should. It should be retroactive. However, in any particular case, who knows what the VA may try to do? So you might have an appeal issue there. So don't overlook that. So that'll be important. The VA may have to go back to when the first claim was filed, as long as that claim was received by the VA after September 24th, 1985, at least as the way the law is now. So basically an example of that would be if a veteran filed a disability claim for type 2 diabetes, which is an Agent Orange-connected disease, that the VA received in 2003, and let's say the VA denied it, and the veteran now files a second disability claim for type 2 diabetes, the veteran should receive disability compensation retroactive to 2003 as long as the veteran served within the 12 nautical mile limit and has suffered diabetes since at least 2003. The 12 nautical mile limit is what the Procopio decision and the Congressional Act from this past summer basically.
So, David, here's another tactical bit of question for you. Do I need to add evidence to my claim to prove that I served within the 12 nautical miles of Vietnam? And if so, what kind of evidence would be appropriate?
Well, according to the NVLSP, again, who I really give a lot of credence to their views, the answer is it depends. Maybe yes, maybe no. The VA has a duty to veterans and their survivors who apply to VA benefits to assist them and obtaining the evidence necessary to substantiate their claims. However, we know, Rick, very well from representing so many veterans, is the VA does not always fulfill its duty to assist, which basically puts the burden then on the veteran's representative to do this. So in many cases, it may be clear to the VA from the veteran's military service records and other VA documents that are already in the file that the veteran served within the 12 nautical miles of the shore. That might be because they recognize through the records that the veteran served on a certain ship that the VA has already recognized served within that distance of the coast. But in other cases, it may not be obvious from the review of the documents, and you should tell the VA the name of the ship and the dates you were on that ship, both of them. Don't just say I was on the USS something or other without mentioning the dates. It's very important because some of these ships may have had multiple cruises to the Vietnam area over 6 or 7 years, or they may have been in the area of the South China Sea, but not anywhere close to 12 nautical miles of the Vietnam coast. So there's a lot of things, and what that basically means is that the VA will try to obtain copies of the deck logs, which were records kept on those Navy ships, which had basic information about where the ship was going and certain other events going on then. And, of course, thanks to the Internet and thanks to the National Archive System, you may be able to access the deck logs for the ship you were on. Not all ships are online, but many ships, their deck logs are posted online through the National Archives website, so you can search there. And even if you don't find those deck logs on the Internet, you can still contact the National Archives to see if they have those. So we've done that in some prior cases. But in the unlikely event that the VA is unable to obtain the deck logs of your ship, then you should submit a statement to the VA with your claim explaining why you believe your ship was within the 12 nautical miles of the shore, you know, including the time frame, things that you observed. Perhaps you could see the land, you know, the coast of Vietnam, and maybe one of the officers informed you that, you know, that it was Vietnam or maybe a particular part of Vietnam that could be corroborated. And so give as much information as you can. And, again, there's power in numbers. So if you can contact some of the fellow crew members of that ship and get what the VA calls buddy statements, they can also testify to the fact that, yeah, you all were that close, you were maybe a mile offshore, then that may make all the difference. But you better do your preparation.
David, go ahead. So, David, I do all that. I get everything in there. Everything I need to prove my case.
Yeah.
And it looks good that I'm going to win my case. How long will it take for the VA to decide my claim toward the disease recognized by VA as associated with Agent Orange?
Another very astute question. In June of this year, 2019, VA Secretary Wilkie ordered VA regional offices and the Board of Veterans Appeals to hold off making any decisions on these claims that are based on service in the offshore waters of Vietnam and involving an Agent Orange issue. This includes not only disability compensation claims, but survivor claims, the dependency indemnity compensation claims. So this moratorium, or basically this hold action on claims, as of now, will remain in effect until January 1st of 2020. So don't expect a decision on your claim until sometime next year. But don't hold off in filing it or in the meantime doing your preparation, as we discussed earlier. So we'll see. I mean, this is like everything else with the VA. It can be complicated, and you just have to see it through. So, Rick, over to you.
Well, and that's all good information. And, you know, veterans, like I said, you know, if you just stay the course with that, you'll eventually, I think, be successful. Moving on to other news, I want to mention some useful resources for veterans in Florida.
Yeah, I think I don't mean to interrupt, but we're about at 7:56 Eastern time here, so I don't know if you want to go to coaching into care.
Okay.
Up to you.
I guess we can then.
Okay.
Yeah, our coaching into care program, we always talk about it. It's not our program, it's the VA program. This is a program that helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching into care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call. The toll-free number is 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's coaching and care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs also has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Well, thanks, Rick. And I understand we have a special guest next week, Mike Partain. Is that right?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Mike has been very active with the Camp Lejeune water contamination cases. And he was recently up in D.C. This past weekend, and they had another big session up there with a lot of veterans, and basically to see where we're going with that. And if you are a Camp Lejeune water contamination veteran, please tune in, because it's you're going to hear some good stuff. It is a bit frustrating from what Mike preliminarily told me, but you know they're pressing on; they're not giving up. So tune in next week to hear Mike. He's always a great guest. Back to you.
Well, it's time for us to go. We want to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and Corey and Hurley Law Group. I'd like to thank our producer, BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Please tune in next week, same time, same station. Until then, we hope you have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.